Screen Divers, and today we are covering 1988's The Blob by Chuck Russell, distributed by TriStar Pictures. And with a running time of 95 minutes, this is a remake of the very famous original The Blob. I think it was in 1958, guys?
1958.
Wait a minute. We're doing the 88 version, not the 58?
We're doing
Oh, God. No, actually, I'm kidding. I actually watched both of them. I watched the 58, then the 88. So,
Steve, this was your pick.
It was. So, do you want me to do the overview?
I think it is time for you to do the overview.
Oh, my God.
We're doing sound effects now. That's what's happening. This is why?
The ball. Why?
Because. Because okay. you I think it was Ricky that implied at some point that we need to inject a level of professionalism here. I don't think so. I really don't think so. We don't. There's no way to attempt professionalism. I don't know what you're talking about, man.
We're not professional.
Steve, no, not at all. Steve, no. Give us what is this movie about?
So, The Blob, obviously it's a remake of the original one from 1958, but this itself is about a deadly entity from space that crash lands near a small town and begins to consume everything in its path. Terror has no shape.
Before we go into the 88, I think one thing I want to play from the original is this great theme tune of The Blob.
Mm.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides.
Okay, off now before demonetization.
I just pictured Adam West dancing to that. I don't know why, but...
Because it will work, that's why.
No, because that's orgy music from the 60s. Why?
Can we just
anyway,
state that...
No. Yeah. Wait a second. I got to put all the blame on you. Whoever's listening to this may have a sense of nostalgia attached to this movie. Mr. Steve came over and we watched it. And if this movie didn't pace as fast as it does, I would have shot myself in the face. But it was Porky's, basically. It's a horror version of Porky's, or at least that's how it starts. But it was enjoyable. It was really enjoyable. Like, we were both tired. Thank you for choosing it. And also, Chuck Russell, dude. Anyone listening to this, including you guys, if you have a favorite Nightmare on Elm Street, doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best one, but I think Dream Warriors is the one.
Yeah.
Bunch of teenagers or tweens. And Chuck Russell can do that very well. In this one, there's a true sense of, small town America. We do get that quite a bit. And there's the waitress, and there's the priest, and there's the sheriff, and there's the rebel, and there's the cheerleader, and the jocks.
We've and the got douchey all of that cop. Here,
right? played by Melting Guy from RoboCop. What's his name? Paul McCrane.
Oh, I forgot. He was in RoboCop.
He plays Deputy Bill Briggs. With a moustache that looks like he's got a bunch of pubes attached to his face.
Oh, my God. But he does play the douchey cop really well.
Dude, that moustache was hard to look at.
It looked like some kind of ginger slug. Absolutely. Happened to be hairy.
Oh, my God. So fucking distracting.
But I've got to say, the only thing about Paul McCrae that I had to look him up because I was like, his face is so familiar. And it wasn't just from RoboCop. I was like, I've seen him like week after week in something. He's in ER. That's You're where joking. I saw him week after week.
As a regular on the show.
Yeah. He was Dr. Romero, Roberto Romero. And he was like the senior house officer who used to give everybody, a hard time until his like big storyline where I think he had MS or something like that.
Oh, you bastard. Now I need to watch ER. Another thing that you admitted publicly, by the way. Jesus Christ. Dude, how much of the show did you watch?
I haven't watched all of it, but I did watch a solid four series.
Now you're fucking retreating for real? No, you ER watcher. tool listening guy.
I said. I watched four series. So if that was like 24 episodes per series, that's a lot. It's a lot.
There's nothing. I'm pretty sure that I never watched the show. I don't think I know the show, but I never like sat down and watch, you know, the show. Maybe I'm coming up short here. Maybe I should. Should I watch ER?
I feel like you're talking to the wrong person here because I'll watch anything.
Okay, all right, fair enough. But I was pleased to see 10,000 character actors in this movie.
My God, yes.
So many, yeah.
Jeffrey Duman. Oh, my God.
Well, yes.
Classic.
Yeah. And we didn't spend enough time with him, man.
No. It's a shame that his character arc quite literally melts away.
Yeah, it looks that guy because of his eyebrows always does perplexed very well. That's the emotion that he does that he conveys in every performance is perplexed. I don't know if you remember, he played Dale in when The Walking Dead was worth watching.
At least
the first five, he was phenomenal. He was phenomenal.
I mean, if we look at the fact that obviously Dale from Walking Dead attached to Frank Darabont as a screenwriter as well. And
of course,
Frank Darabont, we've got to mention him. Yeah, we've got to mention him.
Yeah, we do, because he actually is also in another Darabont movie, which is The Mist.
The Mist.
And one of those bullets at the end of the movie has his name all over
God.
It.
So harrowing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Good things come to those who wait.
Oh, my God.
Ricky, you're not saying anything. Have you seen The Mist, dude?
Yeah. No, I've totally seen The Mist. I'm just like, there was another character actor that actually only pops in for like a minute or if that in this film. And it was Jack Nance from, you know, anything.
Oh, my God.
Oh, anything that is David Lynch, Jack Nance was a part of almost everything.
Doctor?
Yeah, and he literally
stands
up from the deck.
Isn't he the guy that goes fishing? He's the guy that finds Laura Palmer in the show.
He's the big guy. Yeah.
He's in the first. Oh my God!
He's also the main character Harry in Eraserhead.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
but you're right. He's the fisherman. He's the guy that goes fishing and finds Laura in the first episode.
Yeah, holy shit.
Well done, Ricky. That's a good one.
When he like stood up from the desk and went to see like the patient, like I yelled and I was like, "Oh, Jack Nance is in this. I forgot he was." And there's a good reason why I forgot he was in it, because that's the only time you see Jack Nance in the whole film. Mm.
No, that's a good sequence as well. This movie, dude, I can't even say it didn't date well, because it was actually enjoyable. But it is full of tropes. And at the same time, again, we got Chekhov's gun, the law of Chekhov's gun. Is it Chekhov?
Straight away.
Chekhov.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Is it Chekhov's gun?
Pretty early. Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
Are you sure it's Chekhov? Because what's the name Chekhov's. Of the doctor in the original Star Trek?
That's not.
Bones?
That's Bones. Yeah.
Bones.
But no, Chekhov
no,
is
I know he's got a Russian
the,
name.
But... No, the doctor. Oh, my God. This is taking the show. I just fucking... Not the doctor.
Chekhov. Yeah, the Russian guy.
What's his role in Star Trek?
He's like a pilot. He's one of the guys who sits up front.
Is Chekhov...
Does he sit on the desk? Great.
Yeah,
this is what we're going to talk about. We're going to go through the whole of Star Trek and what all their roles are.
Oh, my God.
Is that what we're doing today?
No, we're not. Okay, it is Chekhov's gun. Damn it.
It is Chekhov.
You're right.
Okay, you're right.
As you know, in storytelling, that's an essential kind of rule that gets overlooked these days. But it was kind of nice to find so many instances of that in the narrative of this movie. There isn't a single sequence that makes little sense here. That goes nowhere. That every sequence in a movie like this, by the way, that's unusual. There is shit that doesn't make any sense. Not that doesn't make any sense, but it's kind of verges on the ridicule. Particularly on, I think the actor is called Joe Seneca. He plays Dr. Christopher Meadows.
Dr. Meadows. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the old black guy that has a lot of insight. And all of a sudden he feels that it's appropriate to share it with a bunch of teenagers. And then does a massive exposition dump for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
It's like really classified information, and it just dumps it all on these two kids. It's my life's work. And I turned around to Steve going, I fucking hate you for picking this movie. But it was still enjoyable. By the way, Steve, great overview, but you did fuck something up. And I'm saying this to you just to cover my Chekhov's faux pas earlier, because that's ridiculous. It's any trackie listening to this, at least I didn't say tracker.
You're trying to say that
Steve messed up on something.
It was about your introduction. You said that the blob is from outer space.
No, guess what? I said exactly this. A deadly entity from space crash lands near a small town. The whole point is that I left that open to interpretation. So fuck you, Umba.
Okay, our listeners can go and listen to this. I'm beginning to think that, you know, we started this podcast out of spite. Because we talk a lot of shit, and now there's like recorded proof of our bullshit, which is good. You just go, no, you fucking said that. It's recorded. It's in there. I'm glad that you left it open like that, because you did, because it's one of the major differences between the 1958 version of this movie. 100%. Is the fact that the first one, the blob is an alien creature from outer space, but here, you know, when in the third act with everything is revealed because Dr. Christopher Meadows tells us everything. So we were one of the kids when we watched this movie. But, you know, all this classified information is revealed and, you know, this is a biological weapon, basically. So that's a massive difference between this movie and the original, or at least...
It plays on the Cold War kind of antithesis from that era, especially 1988. Yeah,
100%. It's digging into that. It's digging into, you know, the fear of the bomb or whatever you want to call it, or nuclear war. But there's one thing that I didn't know, and it's a piece of trivia, but we're not going to leave all the trivia at the end of the show because Steve has defied this rule. So from now on, there's no trivia at the end of the show. We'll just dump it all the way through like little poops. And here's my little poop for this one. Jack Harris was the producer of the original film. I don't know who Jack Harris is, but he likes the script for this remake so much, he gave them the rights for free to make it.
Which is he was really happy because he got residuals as well, which was another situation.
Although
the movie didn't make a lot of money in its initial run. It did pull it back.
You know, yeah, this damaged Chuck Russell's career a little bit, man.
Of course, yeah. Went on to do Scorpion King.
Yeah, but it took a while. This came out in 88. And I'm pretty sure, Ricky, can you, while we talk about this, can you do me a favor? Can you bring up IMDb and see what he's done that is notable after Dream Warriors? Mm-hmm. Apparently, Chuck Russell had to publicly be open about the budget, because people were saying, you know, this is pre-internet, basically, when information was spreading, you know, at a different rate. But apparently most media outlets were reporting that the budget for this movie was 19 million. It wasn't. Chuck Russell had to come out and go, it was just under 10, yeah. But he had to do that, because as a director, obviously that's damaging to your reputation, particularly after this movie, basically, like you said, Steve, it grossed, you know, just under 10 million. And I think Near Dark was another movie that suffered from this. If you don't advertise, the movie's not going to do well. And about the state of TriStar. You know, and you guys listening to this, you remember the logo with the unicorn? Or is it it's not a unicorn. It's a Pegasus. It's a Pegasus, yeah. Frank, man, how nostalgic is that logo when it comes on?
Like, oh my God, it's great. I mean, video rentals galore, mate.
Yeah. TriStar Pictures. And they were changing management, apparently, so they didn't spend any money advertising this.
No.
None. But again, just like the original Blob, this is perfect, perfect driving fodder. Have you ever guys, have you ever been to a drive-in?
Yes.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, what an experience. I wonder if this generation has been robbed.
Well, out here in Australia, there are still active drive-ins.
I know, Riggy. I know. I actually went to see, when I was in Australia, it was a special experience. I watched the double bill of Toy Story, the first Toy Story. And what's that Joe Dante movie with the plastic soldiers? What was it called?
Soldier Man. Army Man?
Army Man.
Was it Army Man?
Army Man or is it Soldier? Soldiers.
Small Soldiers. Yeah, it was a double bill.
I remember I had a, you know, like it was a Mitsubishi something station wagon, just opened the back of it. is just great. You know, like an ASCII. I don't know if other parts of the world you could like a cooler, like a cooler full of alcohol,
a cooler,
Toy Story, so good.
Now, as much as we can talk about Chuck Russell's career, where he is still making movies because he's just done a remake of Witchboard this year that's just been released this summer.
Witchboard.
What the fuck is that?
It's like a 1986 classic horror film.
If it was a classic, I would have watched it, and I don't think it is.
No, mate, so, sometimes you miss one. Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've not seen it. Or I don't think I've seen it.
Ricky, just be honest.
But what we need to look at is the fact that he did The Mask. And he did the Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, Eraser.
You erased. Come on.
You are erased.
Is that the one where Arnie goes, why don't you go clone yourself so you can go fuck yourself?
No,
clone yourself and fuck yourself 6 days. Yeah.
Oh, wait a second, Steve. You were pointing this out. Is that the one with the big gun?
It's the one with
this. Wait a second, Steve. I need to fucking shit on you here, Ricky. I asked Steve about a razor, and he goes, no. I made the same mistake, I think, and thought it was the. Is it the ninth gate? Not the ninth gate.
Seventh day or sixth day, like that. Yeah.
So I quoted that, and he goes, no. It was the one with the big gun.
Yeah.
What the fuck? 1,000 movies with Arnie and a Gatling gun.
Okay. So
I know what Steve was going on about.
What was
this? This is basically shoots pellets, basically, which didn't leave any residuals or something like that. It's a it was, oh my god!
What's the movie called again?
Railgun. I think it's called. I think he's using a railgun.
Yeah.
To do the damage, it was quite impressive.
And it has like this huge laser sight on it, and on the front cover, it's basically the laser sight pointing out in the picture with like eraser in typeface and all of this.
For the final and last time, what was the name of the movie?
Eraser.
Okay. All right. Good. So that's we need to watch that.
Let me just rewind back on two things. Number one, Witchboard was basically one of your original Ouija board films, okay?
Oh, so now they're making movies like Ouija, same thing, right?
Yeah.
I think it came out last year or something.
But yeah, let's put that behind us. There's one person we haven't mentioned or discussed that actually has made this film not only watchable, but so much fun. Tony Gardner.
No, we're going to talk about the main cast. Wait a second. Who's Tony Gardner?
No, I'm talking about the special effects guy.
Ah, sorry. We're talking about the cast.
No, special effects guy, Tony Gardner, who is not only behind your favorite Nightmare on Elm Street, but he's also behind all the Chucky designs.
Oh, wow, yeah. You know what? Can I add to what you just said? Apparently, there was another guy that was hired to do this, and he got fired halfway through. There was another dude. Yeah. His name was Lyle Conway, which I don't want to shit on Mr. Conway because I can't say that I don't know his work. One of my favorite musicals, and I don't like musicals, but it's one of all of our favorites. Everyone listening to this would love this version of A Little Shop of Horrors, the one with Rick Moranis.
He
was the one that did the special effects for that, Mr. Conway, Lyle Conway. He got sacked. Chuck Russell didn't like him very much. I mean, it's not that they didn't like him very much, but I think Lyle Conway, like any other professional that works in their field and, you know, is at the top of their game, because, you know, Little Shop of Horrors wasn't a small movie, you would have your way of doing things. And one of the things that he kept insisting in doing, he wanted to use puppets. And Chuck Russell did not want to use puppets. One of the things that actually we can give credit to when it comes down to Chuck Russell's work is a bit of a dreamer. He's a very serviceable director. Like, he's given a project and he makes a movie, fine. There's nothing in his work that screams cinema d'auteur or anything like that, but you give him a movie and he will get the job done. So, and I think one of the things that can blow up budgets is special effects, and this movie was marked by that. There's a few things that went wrong here, including the tanker sequence. apparently leaked the first time. They had to clean up whatever. There wasn't enough slime left. They had to, they couldn't reshoot that entire sequence. And in fact, you can see, I think it's rotoscope or something.
Yeah.
They use a little, there's some, I don't know the exact.
I think they turned to miniatures at one point to fix it. Yeah.
There is some animation, heavy animation in this. It doesn't matter. I mean, the movie got a remaster recently. I think it was remastered at the end of 2023. That's the joy of this. Even if, you know, physical media is dying, there's a lot of little companies that are releasing fresh cuts or remasters or new transfers of older work.
Yeah, there's actually two different versions from the screen as well.
Really?
We're talking about that. Yeah. There's Do You When the Kid Dies Under the Water.
Yeah.
And does the classic Melting Man trick, which we also saw in RoboCop with Paul McCrane, you know. There's a version of it which is a more whitened, more skeleton aspect, which was one screen print which went out. And they changed that version and upped it again. So, it just didn't seem to work.
Yeah. Ricky, thanks for mentioning Mr. Gardner. You're right.
Yeah, because Tony Gardner originally started his career with Rick Baker's crew. And Rick Baker is another master of horror and special effects makeup. So we're talking about Tony Gardner's career started off on like Michael Jackson's Thriller and even Starman with...
Jeff Bridges.
And but then he also was working in Return of the Living Dead. And then he made like, he's uncredited for The Lost Boys, but basically he is a puppeteer master.
Wait a second. Are you saying Tony Gardner was in Return of the Living Dead? He did the work.
He helped out with, so basically he was part of Rick Baker's crew. There was like, and Stan Winston's crew. So whenever there was like something that wasn't quite working, they would just bring in these guys and just go like, could you just like fashion up the corpse for me and things like that. So he's now like, you know, anything that is Chucky related, he's got a hand in. He was in things like Swamp Thing. He did some makeup designs on that.
Great.
Darkman, Sleepwalkers.
Which Swamp Thing? The one with Erickson?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And then also things like The Craft, he helped out with makeup design. He also helped out with Hocus Pocus. And even little things like There's Something About Mary. There was like a little animated sequence with the dog. He helped out with that. So he's basically, we don't know how this thing is going to work. Let's get Tony in. And he just helps out and he just does it.
Tony, we need some cum. We need some cum on Columbia's ear. Could you please, because that's the only special effects I remember from the fucking movie, dude.
Oh, there was this whole...
Exactly the same thing.
There was this whole dog sequence where the dog gets, like, thrown out the window and then they used an animatronic dog that was, like, covered in plaster of Paris to, like, show that, like, it's broken every bone in its body. And, you know, he worked a lot on that stuff.
Cool. There is one thing, guys. Here's another little poop for you guys. It's about... what Chuck Russell did to Shawnee Smith. And obviously with the aid of Tony Gardner, because he wanted to get a method actor performance from her in this movie, he didn't tell her that they were going to put Paul, the actor that plays Paul, her boyfriend, which by the way, that entire sequence is amazing.
Yeah,
the
movie
kicks out, that's a really good sequence. Like, and it's, you know, like I said,
it's subverting as well, because obviously he's brought up to be, you kind of introduced him as the atypical star. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like he's going to be the lead, right?
Yeah. And they do a psycho switch and kill him off. It's great.
Dude, thank fuck for that, because he's got a space between his teeth. Oh my God, it was doing my head in, dude. I just kept looking right through that space. Anyway, whatever. It was distracting, just like the deputy's mustache. But I'm glad he died that way. Anyway, obviously there's cuts throughout. The editing is forced to cut through that sequence so that it's more believable. But the scream that we hear from Shawnee Smith the first time she goes, "Paul," was kind. It's harrowing. And in fact, I turned around to Steve and I went, "Holy shit! What a scream, man!" Shawnee Smith, and she became a scream queen. She doesn't, you know, because of this, she was in Saw, she's renowned for a role as the titular character in Saw. And this one as well kind of launched her career. To be completely honest with you, I always had a soft spot for, well, by soft, I mean the opposite. But anyway, she was, you know, she's a sweetheart. She's a 90s sweetheart. Because of this movie, it really launched her. I think one of the defining thing about the things about her performance is her voice. So it's a shame that she became known as a scream queen, because obviously she does that very well. But she's got, there's a very sweet range. She talks in a particular way. I think possibly it's the accent of where she's from in the States, but her delivery is very kind of cutesy and sweet. And she's older now, obviously. But last time I saw her was in a very formulaic TV show, sitcom called Anger Management. I think it was post the fallout of Charlie Sheen being fired from Two and a Half Men. And she plays his ex-wife in it. And she's funny as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, she's one of the main reasons I love the recent Saw film, Saw X, is her sudden appearance. And it's like, oh, great, we've got Amanda back. Finally, yes.
Yeah.
Even though, like, her, like, you know, you can't stop somebody aging. So her, like, the continuity from, like, Saw 3 to Saw X is so weird. But yes, she's one of the best things about Saw X.
That's the thing. Like, she may be aging gracefully and naturally, thank God, but her voice is still very young. Like, she speaks like a teenager still. It's just the way, you know, she's got a very sweetness about her. There's a little spot in my heart for Shawnee Smith. I think she's great. Ricky, did you finish on Mr. Gardner? Did we sing his praises enough?
I mean, like, we could spend a whole separate episode talking about Tony Gardner, because he's literally got his fingers in so many pies when it comes to special effects.
I'm pretty sure he will pop up in other stuff we'll cover at some point. Yeah.
I'm sure he will.
We were talking about Jeffrey DeMann earlier, which is a guy who plays the sheriff. It's a shame, dude. It's a shame because... And also, there's like a running thread behind what Chuck Russell, I think, does very well. We talked about small town America, how he portrays a little town very well. I actually turned around to Steve and I said, oh my God, is this, which obviously it wasn't, because was Back to the Future Universal Pictures?
Yes, Universal Pictures.
Yeah, obviously you can see that all the sequences in 1955, particularly how the town is kind of showcased in Back to the Future, at one point... You know, I was looking at the layout of that town, but it's obviously a Universal lot, I assume.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's an actual small town. Oh, the Universal
lot. No, in this movie.
Yeah. Okay, in Back to the Future, yes, that's a lot.
That's a lot, right? It's a Universal lot. Do you guys know where it was shot, but where the movie set, which state? I know, but if you don't know, I'll tell you.
I do, and I can't remember it off the top of my head. It's in
California.
My notes.
Is it?
It's California. Because at one point, the sheriff, played by, again, Jeffrey DeMann, talks about bringing a sample of the blob to sending a sample of the blob to Sacramento. So it is the city is meant, like the state is meant to be California. But we know that it wasn't shot there.
No.
And where was it shot, Steve?
Just getting back to my note now. Give me 2 seconds.
Makes great content. Please just.
Hello?
You don't remember, do you?
I don't remember. That's why I'm trying to go back to my notes. I'm going through all my notes. So it starts with an A. That's all I can remember.
Louisiana.
Yeah.
And in fact, it does have.
Abbeville. That's what you were
saying. Abbeville, Colorado. It's Abbeville, Colorado?
No, Louisiana. Yeah.
Louisiana.
And you can see it. It's got a very, like, I remember.
Small town. Yeah, it says Colorado. Yeah,
the trees, the vegetation looks very Louisiana, you know. But anyway, it's meant to be California. But about Jeffrey DeMann's character, what was the name of the sheriff again? And that's the thing. The thing that I wish we spent more time with him.
Oh, yeah, he can 100%. Be
funny. Dude, he's the opening shot of the movie. Yeah, he's one of the first characters we're introduced. Huh?
His name's Herb Geller.
Yeah, which another little bit of trivia. Apparently, his name, he was a famous jazz musician.
Yeah.
Herb Geller. Yeah. So they was a tribute to Jeffrey DeMann.
Yep.
the reason why I wish we spent more time with him is because it seems to me that Chuck Russell is very, just like most of us, is very nostalgic about his teenage years.
Yeah.
And he does Rite of Passage quite well, and that's why Dream Warriors became so, because it's not a great movie, but it does leave a mark. For our generation, the movie left a mark because it kind of demarks Rite of Passage. And, it, you know, you have all these archetypes like the jocks, the stoners, you know, like you have these groups like John Hughes, you know, does very well. He kind of, in the horror field, he does that very well. And one of the characters that I remember very well from when I was a kid is John Saxon as the father. That character keeps popping up in the Nightmare on Elm Street series throughout because he represents the parents not believing what, you know, the younger generation is saying, basically. He's kind of represents authority, not only by being a cop, but here they don't play on that. And it's a shame because Kevin Dillon's character is the rebel, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so we do have, that's why he's the lead in this, by the way. Because he's fighting the government. You know what I mean? He's the one who's fighting against in this. Mm. Kevin Dillon. And we're going to talk about Kevin Dillon. Mm. Man.
Well,
go on.
Because out of the three of us, I watched the 58 movie followed by the 88 movie.
Yeah.
The way the 58 movie is that the 58 movie is generally how a small town got together and help destroy this monster. So when the way the 58 movie is done is that you have Steve McQueen as
in his
like
first starring
the main
role.
Character. Yeah, mm. as his first time he was, yeah. you know, the lead.
Yeah.
And he and his girlfriend are not believed by authority or even barely by their friends or their peers that this is happening to them. And they finally are able to talk the sheriff into like believing them, and the sheriff sides with them, but his deputy doesn't. And then it turns out his deputy was wrong to like doubt them. But they bring the whole town together to defeat this monster. The reason why so many choices I feel like happened in this film was sort of to buck that ideology. So, you know,
exactly.
the boyfriend and the girlfriend. That it was yep. a bit like, okay, let's get rid of the boyfriend. And that way yep. she has to go with Kevin Dillon. Now, in my mind, the reason why I don't feel like that was done well is because Kevin Dillon is the first name you see on the screen. So you know he's going to be the lead of the film.
You're right.
Yeah, the second thing about this was the sheriff. Now, if you're in 1988 and you're about to go see The Blob, you've probably seen the 58 movie, or at least its sequel.
Reruns on TVs, yeah.
Yeah, or you've gone to you know, a drive-in and or a special showing like the Prince Charles or whatever. Mm. So you would have seen it, and you would have been like, okay, the sheriff's safe, because the sheriff's the one who believes the teenagers and moves on. And so I think, apart from the scene early on where the boyfriend gets killed, the scene with the sheriff being like melted in front of yep. Fran Hewitt, the character Fran Hewitt.
Candy was, Clark, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Candy Clark.
Yeah, it was Candy Clark.
Yeah.
It was really genius. It was really yep. clever.
Perfect.
Because yeah. if you sat down, you'd be like, oh, there's the sheriff. He's going to be safe. The next, you know, it's like, oh, he's going to turn up to the diner and he's going to suddenly, oh, he's dead. It was yeah. brilliant.
No, I agree with you. Like, yeah, I'm not. Then, look. The role but, that he.
Anyway, no, I understand what you're saying. Like, it's a waste of a actor and all of that
no,
stuff.
No, yeah, that's right. Because, but like, for I example, feel... dude, wait a sec. Obviously, all these choices make sense to service the story. It's just that the character that John Saxon played in Nightmare on Elm Street was quite prominent. And I remember that from when I was a kid. So I'm not,
yeah.
that character's not meant to leave a mark at all. He's meant to play the establishment and that's it. You know, you're not meant to remember the father. But again, he used another character here in this movie where you kind of remember the father. One of the best jokes in the movie involves
Fantastic.
A father in this.
Yep. Art and Fleur. That is classic.
Yeah, they missed the joke of for her pleasure.
Yeah, I know. I did say it. Yeah,
father's saying it, so you know what I mean.
Like, and he already knows.
Yeah, you know, that guy, by the way, another character that's like, in Italy we have this saying, obviously everything's related to food, but it's like, come il prezzemolo. Prezzemolo means parsley. And one of the things is, if you like cooking, parsley is one of those herbs that you use in a lot of things, or at least in Italian cooking you do. So when you refer to someone as being like parsley, it means that they're fucking everywhere. And in this case, Art LaFleur, because I looked, look at his credits. He's in everything.
Field of Dreams.
He's in everything. But there are so many actors, so many faces that just keep popping up. And there's one of them in particular here. It's someone you remember, but I don't know his name. It's the guy that plays the projectionist in this.
Frank Collision.
Dude, that guy is in everything. He was in everything. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. But going back to my point,
we're talking about Jeffrey LeMann and why he died so early. It's a shame.
Also talking about that the script is stylized in a way so that, you know, those who are fans of the 58 movie get a little bit of a, oh, I don't know what's going to happen next. But I also find that the worst thing about what they did with the script was have that governmental conspiracy thing, which, yes, for the time, it was absolutely right, the Cold War, all of that stuff.
And it also subverted the original situation, which is it's from outer space. Which is, you know, it's
they also do. Totally, can I just say, to reinforce Ricky's point, you're right, but they didn't really double down on it because sudden this enemy becomes a common enemy very fast. So I really wanted like a piece of shit government here, and you don't get that because these guys are fighting back very quickly. There's the turning point in the movie where, okay, in the end, the only person who turns out to be the villain here is the priest.
There's two villains, Joe Sakina as Dr. Meadows and the priest, which is Del Close.
Ooh, Joe Seneca.
Yeah,
The old black guy.
Christopher
Meadows.
Dr. Meadows.
Yeah, but it's hard to take him seriously, man. That entire sequence when he goes, this is my life. It ends with, this is my life's work.
It's his life's work. It's what he created, put into orbit, and was.
But he's not really a villain. There's even a moment in which he's challenged by one of his subordinates. Really, we can't do this. Like, okay. And he basically goes, justifies it. It just doesn't go, fuck off, I'm doing this. No, he goes, we need to sacrifice a few. So, still, in his own right, he thinks he's right. Yeah. That doesn't make him villainous, it just makes him wrong. It's different. I don't know. I think I like the madness of the character played by Del Close. As soon as he came on screen, I went, dude, this is the guy that, and for our listeners, we're going to state this over and over again. Sometimes we bank the episodes, we record them in advance, so you'll never know when. I can tell you right now that we have covered the movie that I'm about to mention. So surprise, surprise, not. The movie in question is The Untouchables. So soon, I don't know when on the schedule we are going to release that episode, but the actor in question has very defined facial features. I really like this character, actor. And the moment you see Del Close on screen, doesn't know what it looks like him. He always has glasses, round frames. He plays the guy that throws the bribe at Elliot Ness.
He goes
when he goes to the headquarters and tries to bribe Elliot in The Untouchables. It's the same thing. Ricky, you noticed?
Yeah. Gets beaten up very much like Paul Dano does, or how I enjoy Paul Dano to be beaten up.
But he's the villain in this.
There's another little bit of trivia of this as well, because he's in the Son of a Blob. He's in the Son of a Blob.
Yes,
he is.
He stole that from the hobo wearing the eye patch, which but this kind of goes to the end of a movie where he's wearing technically an eye patch.
Yes, he is.
Bigger eye.
Because of the injury he gets in this. Yeah. Can I just say there's a very creepy sequence with him in this? Oh, he does creepy very well. Yeah, and it's in the pharmacy. There's a joke in the opening sequence of this movie that actually hits back later with a punchline via the character played by Art LaFleur, which is the character actor we mentioned earlier that plays Shoni Smith's dad, the pharmacist. Yeah. And it's about two jocks going to the chemist because they're going to go out and they want to buy some condoms. So, you know, a little bit of Porky's in there because that's, I mentioned that earlier. That's when this movie reminded me of Porky's. Exactly. I thought, what the fuck? But it's, you know, it's all in good fun until the same character kind of gets rapey later on. We're going to talk about that sequence. What was the name of Scott? Was it Scott?
Scott Jeske.
Yeah.
Which was to all the ladies Ricky listening, Paul Golden. never accept a drink from Mr. Jeske. fucking hell, dude. That did not date well at all.
Oh, actually, no.
Date well. That's dated a pun well, in there as well.
But didn't you find it a little unnecessary that the creature, the blob, did a bit of a wait and bait to kill him? Like, he could have killed him at any time, but no, he waited until, like, the buttons started being undone and all that stuff.
No,
the blob could have killed him at any time, but it was just like, let's make sure that SA's involved, and then, oh my god, the blob.
We're going to talk about that entire sequence in a moment, by the way, because that trunk of that car, I wonder if any of us, because I don't have the recollection of this, and thank god for that, I wonder if any of us thought that guy was somehow cool when we were kids.
Because
of the wait a second, because of the setup of his car. He had a bar in the back of his trunk.
Not
the
only just the bar, but he also had the rings. But...
Yeah, okay, fine. But the point is that it's more of a lab at this point. You know what I mean? It's more the guy carries his rapey lair with him in the back of his car.
It reminded me of the Aladdin's chest, you know, like, oh, the Cave of Wonders, the Trunk of Wonders.
Yeah.
Now, in The Chemist, Scott is about to buy condoms after he borrows $5 to buy condoms from what turns out to be the father of Shawnee Smith later on. We don't know this yet. And the priest is kind of talking to him like, oh, you don't come to church anymore, this and that. But that entire conversation gets creepier and creepier, and creepier because Del Close's facial expression. At one point, you can see his face contorting with something that is a mixture of interest and arousal.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's fuck, dude, it's super weird. It reminded me of The Whispering Man. And I remember when we were watching The Untouchables, I kept thinking of The Whispering Man in Willy Wonka.
Oh, yeah.
It's got it's similar
facial
features. It's the
same, like, telescopic lenses that he was wearing and stuff like that, yeah.
Well, you're talking about his glasses.
Yeah, like, you know when you get those sort of lenses that just kind the of shows how so bad thick. Your eyes, your eyesight is, that your eyes start, like, becoming fishbowl sort lenses. Of lenses. Yeah.
But there's this bit where his face, as Scott is basically, you know, his back is against the wall. You know, his condoms are being handed to him, and the priest all of a sudden is still there, kind of challenging his morality. But his face is contorting in so many ways and very quickly. Like, it's super creepy. I thought it was very creepy, and I just thought, is that arousal? Like, what the fuck is this sequence? Like, it's really, really weird. Well,
remember, I come from a Catholic background, and I've seen that kind of look on priests before. Let's just say that.
Are you fucking kidding me? I grew up in Rome, dude.
I know, but Catholic schools.
We're not talking badly about Christianity. We still have the imprint, but it's a question of
I work in a Catholic school, so you know, Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, everybody. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, of course. I'm agnostic, man. I'm sitting right on the fence, and that fence is jammed up
anybody,
my ass.
Anybody who knows where I work or works with me, I do not I do, delete me out of this conversation right now.
The name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay, all right. Anyway, moving on. This movie is comprised by so many familiar faces. Yeah. And I'm going to lead us into Kevin Dillon.
Kevin Dillon.
Can I just say, guys, I was so misguided years ago. A friend of mine, some of you may have met him. His name was Yanni. He passed away. But it was one of those instances in which a friend tells you for years, he's asking you, he's begging you, he's pleading with you to watch something. And you just go, no. Then it becomes a spiteful thing in which you just, because you said no once, you just keep saying, no, I'm not going to watch it just because you want me to.
Well, they're bartering with me and you.
Pretty much, yeah. I find many of those pointless battles. I've got mine with you. I've got some with Ricky. But it's, hey, come on. This is an homage to our friendship, all right? That's all it is. Because it takes an effort to say no as well. But in this case, he kept raving about a show when it came out called Entourage.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying no just because of how enthusiastically he kept asking me to watch it to the point of being forceful. And I went, no. First of all, I cracked at some point, and he was right. There's a couple of performances in that show. Even if it dated, there are a reason to watch the show.
Oh.
Kevin Dillon's performance as down and out child star or whatever the fuck he was in the show called Johnny Drama Chase.
Mate, Johnny Drama Chase, yeah.
It is phenomenal. He's so fucking funny in it. And it kind of tainted the rest of his career for me. Like, because every time I see him on screen, I think of that performance. And the thing that didn't help here is that I didn't know, because as a man, you don't tend to notice these things when it comes. Like, I didn't notice Johnny Smith had extensions in the movie.
Apparently, it's something that he does.
Chuck Russell demanded.
Like, yeah. He didn't.
He did. What are you talking about? Chuck Russell demanded for Shawnee Smith to wear extensions. She didn't like them. She didn't like wearing them.
No, it's not. It's Kevin Dillon.
Kevin Dillon. He also asked for Kevin Dillon to sport a mullet. And it's a hell of a mullet, man.
I tell you what, it did remind me very much of Michael from Lost Boys. I felt it was very much a Michael. Yeah, like,
absolutely.
Archetype.
But the reason why Chuck Russell did this, he actually modeled Shawnee Smith's character and Kevin Dillon's character on two people that he knew in high school. So those roles, and those are the hairstyles that those people had. And he demanded for that mullet, which is not what Kevin Dillon was sporting at the time. So there are extensions.
Yeah.
And Shawnee Smith's character as well. So also the other character that he knew was caught was the rapey guy.
The rapey guy.
Which, by the way, I'll give this to Ricky. Ricky, can you do us a favor and tell us, can you talk us through the entire sequence in the car with Scott the Jock?
Okay. So, Scott the Jock.
I would really want to get you fired, dude. I'm trying to...
many have tried, man. Many have tried. So Scott the Jock has taken his victim, let's say, to a makeout point somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and he is talking to her, speaking sweet nothings, and she is passing out. And
she is at the beginning of the sequence. It's not, we don't even meet her before that. She is
full on passing out. And he then goes, oh, I'm going to just go make her some more drinks, love. And so, like, walks out of the car and pops open the trunk where he's got – where for some reason he has a fur-lined basketball hoop. That's the first thing I noticed.
Yeah, that's
like,
the fucking weirdest thing.
What is that even?
He's not even a basketball player.
He's a football player. Yeah. He's got, like, mounds and mounds of different – drinks, like many. It cuts away repeatedly to show you the blobs coming towards the car.
Is that meant to be like the perfect kegger setup for a high school kid? It's like pops the trunk open and there's the, you know, like there's a bunch of, you can play, you can rape, you can make a drink.
As Steve said, the whole like rings thing was meant to be a sort of like a, you know, he picks up girls and probably does the whole like, you know, this is my like my player's ring and you should wear it around your neck to show everybody that like we're the one and we're together and all this stuff and drink this.
I mentioned Chekhov's gun earlier throughout the entire Star Trek incident. And this is another example. That ring again pops up later. Yeah. So I'm going to leave this with Steve for later. That ring pops up later. In the opening sequence when he crashes the bike, that happens later. So it's 101. Yeah. It's clinical. He does that very well. Anyway, continue. Yeah. Sorry.
Anyway, so he finally like makes the two drinks and he sits back down in the car and tries to offer her the drink, but she's passed out, inverted commas, blah, blah, blah. Instead of like trying to see how she's going, he starts undressing her slowly. And you can see the ring around the necklace and all of that stuff around her necklace to prove that he's already given her the ring and she's his main squeeze and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, And again, this sequence is long. It's probably about 2 minutes. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, the blob kind of bursts out, like starts choking him out, starts like invading him and all that stuff. But also, the face turns towards him, crushes in on itself, and then shoots all over him.
I love the fact you said shoots all over him.
Steve pointed out the physics of the way Scott dies are so rewarding because his body just falls the wrong fucking way. And you know he's dead because his leg just goes a different way. And it reminded me, the way Scott dies reminded me of one of the deaths in one of my favorite anthology, the anthology question, and you guys have to just, you can only agree here. It's the raft in Creepshow 2. One of the kids in the raft. Which, by the way, the monster in that is, guess what? A blob.
Blob.
Yeah. Do you remember? It was the same creature. Oh my God, the same creature, right? It's the entire... You guys, too much silence here. You remember what I'm saying here. You know what I'm talking about,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
I just agreed with you. For God's sake.
Okay, there you go. Sorry. Yeah. But there's a bit when one of the, again, teenagers gets pulled through the center of the raft and his body just falls like a folding chair.
That is one thing. And again, Tony Gardner, his team, and all of that stuff. That is one thing I've got to say about this movie. Every single death, every single killing in this movie is inventive and it is painful.
It's painful memorable. To watch. Memorable. Absolutely. 100%. Even when we look at right at the beginning with Can Man, Billy Beck, who's actually titled as Can Man from the beginning of the movie, his death is fantastic. That whole lead up to this point is really, really
I'm still confused, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve's excitement in pointing out that this character was called Can Man all the way through the... Dude, we were watching the movie, and he goes, that's Can Man, that's Can Man. I was like, what the fuck? I don't understand what your fascination is with this character, even when we're watching the movie.
I mean, Billy Beck has been in a lot of different things over his career.
Has he?
I mean, he has. Near Dark, Mystery Men, Just Like Heaven.
What? He's in Near Dark?
Yeah, he's in Near Dark.
And he's a mystery man.
Is he the guy that runs the hotel?
Yeah.
The motel?
Yeah. Motel manager. Yeah. He's a motel manager in Near Dark.
Okay. Long live Can Man. I get it.
So this guy appeared
in Near Dark. Lance Erickson is trying to get the keys before sunlight starts creeping in across the desk because he can't reach for the keys because of sunlight coming in. That's why I remember Can Man.
Obviously, we grew up watching these movies, Near Dark, The Blob, and everything else. I mean, like, and seeing him reprise a kind of weird role each time, but only being titled by Can Man. I actually, my VHS copy of this tape from the 80s, I mean, it got rewatched so many times. Like we used to have popcorn movies nights with this with my mates. That's it. So it was like we all cheered when he came on screen because we knew it was the first death is coming up. You know, it's great.
Yeah,
I feel bad. I feel very bad for not I didn't notice this, and you should as well because I'm about to drop a bomb. Not a little poop. This is a bomb. I've got my notes open in front of me here. I just noticed with the corner of my eye, are we going to say actress throughout the show? Can you still say actress? I like actor should be used for both, right?
Yeah.
I actually had
actor for Shawnee Smith as well. So,
There you go.
You know, yeah.
Erika Eleniak is in this. Eleniak was one of the girls that I had a massive crush on when I was a kid. And you do as well, I think.
I can't think of the name.
I think she is the almost rape victim in this. The almost essay victim. Don't tell me.
I did not recognize her at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And also her face got like completely destroyed within a minute. So, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. She wasn't easily. Well, actually, not just destroyed, but it became kind of what killed Scott, because all those tentacles come out of her face.
You know, amazing. Like she's shot all over the place. I'll just say that again.
Yeah, you did say that. Yeah. Man, it's terrifying. Some of the effects in this are great.
Yeah, I know, it's fantastic, and the fact that most of it's just silk sheets. It's crazy.
Yes, it is.
Silk sheets. They put like clear balls inside it, and they used something which they use for milkshakes.
So some
thickening agent which they spread over it. And one of the bits of trivia is that Chuck could not smell milkshake after this film was completed for like years. He just couldn't.
What are you talking about?
He
couldn't smell a milkshake.
Yeah, no, he couldn't, as in it made him feel
physically ill. Yeah, so.
Guys, you know where you remember Eric Galeniak from? Under Siege.
I thought you were going to say Baywatch.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but Under Siege, she comes out of a cake. In Under Siege. I never forget that movie, dude. Yeah. We're going to have to cover Under Siege with Mr. Seagal, Gary Busey, Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Man, I went to see that. Oh, my God. 2 days. I went to see Under Siege and The Mask around the same time in the theater by myself years ago. Under Siege is a disaster.
See, the thing you've got for Under Siege, I think for me, it was a Bordello of Blood. Crypt movie.
Okay. Ricky, anything else you would like to talk about?
One last thing, because we're picking on actors that, you know, again, this film is so full of character actors or like people that like have careers now or people that we know for other things. Bill Moseley, he is one of the soldiers in the sewer who they get the bazooka from. So Bill Moseley, and for people out there who are like, oh, Bill Moseley, what's he in? Yeah, he's pretty much it. He's in every Rob Zombie film. Rob Zombie film, he gets brought in. He is one of the Firefly from House of a Thousand Corpses, Devil's Rejects, and the third one, Free from Hell. Yes, that's the one.
Mm-hmm.
Which I still haven't watched.
Have you not?
No.
Which one?
I haven't watched it.
Free from Hell.
By then.
Well, look.
Yeah.
Funnily enough.
Now, okay, sorry, but Rob Zombie is making movies for his wife to star in at the moment.
Okay. I would.
You want to talk about the remake of The Monsters? You want to go there?
No. I don't want to. Okay. Let's not, like, because I haven't seen that for a reason. Even Free from Hell.
Mm.
I know that it doesn't have. I've forgotten his name now. Who's the one who passed? Who was from?
Clown.
The one that played Captain Spaulding.
Yeah.
He was amazing.
Anyway, he. I know he
passed away. Yeah.
Yeah, he passed away, so they had to replace him. But the choice they used to replace him was Richard Brake, Sid Haig. That's his name.
He's a grindhouse legend, dude.
Absolutely. But like they got Richard Brake in to replace him, and Richard Brake is also of that caliber of like, you know, you know his face, and especially seeing a movie like 36. No, is it 36? The Rob Zombie film about basically like a horror house.
Yeah.
Full of like murder and everything. 36? And
You're talking about Richard Brake.
Richard Brake, yes.
Yeah, he's got a particular face, dude.
Yeah, he's doing. But anyway, Bill Moseley is in this film. And Bill Moseley has about 7 lines, but he delivers it in a Bill Moseley way. And he doesn't pull back, and he's just full on. And I loved every single second Bill Moseley was on the screen.
And I'm surprised that Steve is being completely silent here, because
I'm not being silent.
Richard Brake is Welsh.
There
you go.
Okay, there you go.
31. That's what That's what it's called, 31.
I didn't realize he was Welsh, actually.
Yeah. He's also in Barbarian, by the way. I remember him now.
Movie. Yeah.
Yes. He's in that. He's in Barbarian.
Yeah, he is.
He's the guy that plays the father.
Yes, And yeah, he has that amazing third person camera following sequence that lasts for about 10 or 15 minutes
of the film. Don't give away the ending, please.
But that sequence where the camera is just following him for about 15 minutes, genius.
Absolutely genius. I enjoyed that movie endlessly. The ending, everything about it.
It's one of my highlights from last year. Enough. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, that and No One Will Save You that we talked about earlier. I watched those back to back. I thought, Barbarian is really, really good. If you guys haven't seen Barbarian, are we recommending it?
Oh yeah, we recommend it 100%. Like,
make sure that you have a glass of milk as you watch it.
Oh mate, the one thing I really, really loved about Barbarian, and I've said this to many people who have asked me, like, why do you rate that film, or like, why should I watch it? It was one of the first films in a long time where I was literally shouting at the screen, no, don't do that. What are you doing? Why would you do that? What are you doing?
As she's walking down the stairs.
Yes, exactly. Like, why? No, don't do that.
I can stop that. You're saying that, but I have another movie that gets you to do that all the way through it, all the way through the running time. And that is Speak No Evil. Which is phenomenal. Yes. Didn't need a remake.
Speak No Evil.
As you know, Speak No Evil does not need a remake. Steve, you and Murray watched that here with us, right?
I know.
We watched it together. It's a phenomenal movie that did not need a remake. As much as I love James McAvoy, I think he's a phenomenal actor.
Also, I'm just going to say one thing. The trailer is an absolute freaking disaster.
You know what? Whoever the fuck did that needs to fucking leave the industry. Whoever thought somebody... No, mate, I'm telling you, Ricky, you're laughing, but there's nothing more irritating than the trailers for this fucking movie. The movie relies on information that you're given as the movie progresses, and they had the gumption of putting two major plot spoilers in the trailer. It's fucking brutal.
Really messes it up. I mean, like, the entire story. I can't watch this movie as a remake. I really will not.
I'll watch it just because of McAvoy.
I've got to say that this is really, like, I'll be honest.
Dude, you have seen Speak No Evil? I have not seen
the original.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Look, but now, Sally and myself, we're non-trailers. The only trailers we see is when we go to the cinema. But now, even like if somebody goes, oh man, they've just dropped a trailer for Beetlejuice, we're like, no. We don't.
But do you know how difficult it is for anybody to do that these days?
I do really well. I try my hardest.
Your ability to do so will diminish as time passes. And the reason why is because it's a barrage. It's a continuous assault on the senses. Wherever you turn, your phone, advertising everywhere. It's in your pocket as well. So you really have to exercise continuous self-control not to do it. And sometimes that happens by mistake as well. You may stumble. But this is an insult that doubles down on how intruding it is, because you are sitting in a darkened theater. You're talking about not watching a trailer. A group of us, we're in the theater, so it doesn't matter how much I force myself. What are you going to do? You're going to cover your eyes? We're talking about the trailers before a movie, and there was this trailer for the remake of Speak No Evil that, first of all, the first reaction that we got, because we have seen it, and I suggest you watch it, Ricky, as soon as possible. Watch it with Sally, and you'll see why we're recommending it. Don't read anything about it. Obviously, you already are going out of your way not to see a trailer.
Yeah.
After you watch it, we'll have a chat. But you were talking about an instance in which you're shouting at the screen, don't do this, don't do that, and Barbarian being a paragon for that. No, dude, Speak No Evil will have you doing that 10 minutes in, because it's a sticky movie. It stays with you. And then after you watch it, we'll discuss. There's a reason why that movie cannot be remade. And the reason why is because of the history of the countries involved. It's a Danish movie, and the entire movie is an analogy for fascism. That's all I'm going to tell you. But you need to watch it. And I think they completely missed the point in the remake. The only reason why I would watch the remake in this instance is McAvoy. Because, man, thank God for the guy. First of all, he's an advocate for the industry in a good way and for the arts.
Yes.
I watched a few interviews in which he's trying to push younger generations into the arts, into drama and acting in a positive way. And I really like that. Secondarily, he's a fucking phenomenal actor. He does have Split. So much range.
Oh my God, Split.
Yeah, and thirdly,
fucking amazing.
I met him in a supermarket and he was nice to me. So.
There you go. That wins over Umbar, full stop. Like, they can make the worst movie in the world, but if you're nice to him on the street... It's all good.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't like it. I'm a fan. But anyway, he's... No, come on, man. He's got range.
Yeah, like, no, range. I mean, like, look.
He can play a good guy. He can play a piece of shit. He can play a back... He does it so fucking well. And he's a lead. Not a character actor. He's a lead actor, dude.
Yeah, and when they did, like, the I'm going to call them the prequels, but let's just call them another timeline or whatever, of the X-Men, I thought there's nobody who could do Professor Xavier like Patrick Stewart, and he did.
And he did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Anyway, now we're talking about a movie that you haven't even seen, Ricky, so let's drop this one. But to you and to our listeners that have not seen Speak No Evil, it's a Danish movie, but it's not with subtitles. Please go watch it. Stop listening to this. Go watch the movie and do not watch the remake until at least you have seen the original. Stay away from trailers.
Do I have to leave?
No.
No. It will make you feel very uncomfortable.
Oh, actually, can I leave? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, go. You may be excused. Anyway, so Barbarian. We were talking about Barbarian because of the tie in with Richard Brake.
But all of that is from the fact that Bill Moseley is in the 1988 Blob, and you can't not feel the Bill Moseley that we know from all of the Rob Zombie films that Bill Moseley's in.
Absolutely. And there's 100%. Also a segue to go on now. It's about the sequence with the bazooka. You guys fight among yourselves, please.
Oh my God. I'm sure you want to talk about this.
You know what, dude? I forgot that this bazooka is as iconic as the Arnold John Matrix bazooka in Commando.
It's the same. It's the same bazooka that they use in Falling Down, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a single barrel. Commando's got four, right? There's like four. The one that he has over his shoulder.
This thing can make a hole in a tank.
Wait a second. Was that bazooka in Falling Down, dude?
Yeah, of course. There's that whole scene where the road works aren't being done. And he's stolen a bazooka off, and I can't remember the actor who plays it, but the Nazi.
Well, is it the creepy guy in the store?
So he steals a bazooka off that guy.
Store, whatever.
Yeah, and he goes back to the roadworks, and he says, like, why isn't the road being fixed? And the guy's like, I'm on my lunch break. And then he pulls out a bazooka, and then a kid,
remember now,
like a 14-year-old, helps him work out how to fire the bazooka.
Is that the roadwork sequence, right?
I
remember now. I love that movie. We need to cover that movie. Robert Duvall is so fucking good in that.
And Schumacher. Oh, it's all Schumacher.
God. Schumacher. It's full Schumacher. Yeah.
Steve.
So Brian, played by Kevin Dillon, basically takes an anti-tank rocket launcher from the back of... I think
Bill
Soldier Bill 2. Soldier 2. That's what it's naming. In sewer, as far as IMDb is concerned on this one. So not even a name. And basically fires it one-handed.
It's super ridiculous.
Imagine the sound, by the way. Not just the kickback, but the sound. Right. Because he fires it in what's a...
Oh, my God.
It's like a manhole, right? Space, it's
like fires it up over a manhole, which is covered by
the debris alone that it would cause. The debris kill them.
He's doing... Yeah, remember how he's holding the bazooka by one hand and he looks the other way? Like you would lighting up like a firework when you're a kid. Like, what the fuck? It's absolutely ridiculous, and you can see the results of that firing, by the way, in the next sequence.
Do you want to talk about that?
no, sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
So obviously what we end up having is an absolute carnage of a vehicle and everywhere cleared out. It's absolutely crazy. I mean, like, all props to the special effects team for just getting a dismantled car. and exploding that vehicle right out over the crowd. It's crazy.
Because the vehicle was standing over the manhole, right? So they couldn't they couldn't exit. No. So he's creating an exit one-handedly.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
It's a bit heavy-handed, let's just say that.
It is. Look, man, I suspended disbelief by this point anyway.
It's a movie. Know, like, this is what we meant to do.
Yeah, yeah. There's another sequence. And we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, take the lead here and tell us about how ridiculous what I mentioned earlier is. The actor in question is Joe Seneca. Nothing terrible about his performance, but it's just the writing that is really, really bad here. And it's about how he tells these two kids are on the run and they apprehend them in the most polite and in it's just basically there's an actor, by the way, that has two lines in this movie. One of them is get in the van, and the other one, do you remember that? It's the guy that plays the one of the henchmen. He's the one that
Jennings. Was it Jennings?
Yeah. Jennings, whatever the fuck his name is.
Robert he's the same Axelrod. One who's
he's the same one who throws the grenades into the. Oh, actually, he kills himself. He has the two grenades stretched to his chest. Another reason why they are there, by the way, because I remember seeing this guy and he's got two grenades above his nipples. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, I mean, look, this is why.
Whoa, Ricky, wait a second.
Yeah, sorry.
I wanted you to describe Dr. Meadows' behavior.
Look, what does he I mean, the whole thing about this and about Dr. Meadows being like the bad guy or the villain of the piece is just so weirdly paced, because the rest of the film is paced so well that actually when you see Dr. Meadows, he just dumps stuff constantly. Like, oh, yes, you're talking about that. Well, I can tell you now, little Janie and little Susie and you, you're a boy. Anyway, let me tell you about like all this stuff going on around here. And it's and get in the van. It's one of those things where when you watch something from the 1950s or 1960s and it's like a horror film or a space film or whatever, they talk way too much. Like, you will have like the original thing from outer space. There's so much chatter and so much like, we've opened a door. There's nothing behind this door. Let's go into this room.
Yeah, because obviously they need to explain what you can't do visually. So fine.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
All of this exposition about what is going on, it's not meant to be shared with two civilians.
No.
Who are fucking kids.
God, no.
Yeah.
Like, and you are telling them absolutely fucking it. Okay, you're withholding some information. Thank God for that. But not only that, but then there's a bit of emotion as well in which this is my life's work. Yeah. I waited all my life for this moment. Like, it's what the fuck are you doing? What are you doing?
Like, okay, so what I felt, and I know I'm like kind of avoiding the subject of like everything he's like dropping and just telling them at random points. But like what
because
I found
it's
really
classified. That's why you're not revealing it to our listeners.
Yeah, but also like what I found really weird about it is that for a film that's really punchy and really like quick, I didn't feel that I knew any of the characters. And so when this Dr. Meadows is just dumping information and saying, this is my life's work, it's like, we can only take it by his word. Because, like, we don't sit with the characters long enough to be like, yes, it is his life work, or yes, they're doing the best for the town, or yes, they are scared of this creature and all of that stuff. So even when Dr. Meadows, and spoilers, Dr. Meadows passes, it's a little bit like all the other characters just go, well, he's not on the scene anymore. Let's all defeat the blob now.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. I agree. This is the bit as well, because obviously the action is slowing down that you start noticing other things. Because I lost the interest in whatever the fuck Dr. Meadows revealed at some point, because it was so fucking funny. It was ridiculous. Every time he dumped so much info on these two, I thought, okay, I kind of shot it, and I started noticing other stuff. And one of the things that I started noticing in that sequence was the score Michael Honig. I don't know who he is. It wasn't great, okay?
No.
And at one point, I turned around to Steve, and I went, oh, the music. You know what would have sounded? Because that's when we start, in that sequence, when Dr. Meadows talks to the kids, you're given the information that is important about this is not, you know, he knows more than He knows a little bit more, but he kind of is giving it away. But this is a weapon, right? So yeah, you get that dystopian feeling, and that's when John Carpenter starts creeping in. And I turned around in my head at least, and I thought, holy shit, this movie, as much as I'm enjoying it now, would have been a very different movie that I would have enjoyed just as much, if not more, if it was directed by Carpenter, and he would have gone fully like anti-establishment with it.
And some people would argue that like The Thing, which is like by all means one of the best remakes ever made, ever.
Yeah, 100%.
Is very close in that regards.
Like, absolutely.
But yeah, they 100%. stuck with it's an alien from outer space.
It's an alien from outer space, yeah. That's when I, as soon as I had that thought going through my head and I said that to Steve, 5 minutes later there's a tune that comes on, very minimal kind of electronic kind of almost heartbeat.
Yep.
And I thought, shit, that this movie would have felt even like much more akin to something that Carpenter did, because obviously the music in The Thing, the music in They Live is very Carpenter because it's composed by him. But this movie would have had, that's when kind of tried to emulate that a little bit. When the government conspiracy is fully out in the open and all of a sudden you'll know that this is not a creature from outer space in this movie, but it's a weapon. U.S. government fucked up. This has gone out of hand now. I'm trying to contain it. That's when the music changes. And when you start getting tones of Carpenter, it goes more minimal, less gory. Do you remember that, Steve? We were watching it. It's a shame that it wasn't cohesive. I get why all the way through, because otherwise you would have had this conspiratorial kind of vein running through the entire movie from the beginning. But yeah, the tone shifts in this. And I don't know. Look, there's not much to be said here. I enjoyed it, but Steve, this is on you. You picked this movie this time.
I did pick it. It's a film from my childhood. It's something
it's a
which
classic, yeah.
I don't see this being reviewed that much. You know, it's one of his films. Yeah, it's one of his films which, you know, we grew up on horror. We grew up on sci-fi. We watched The Thing. We watched The Blob at the time. It's one of those staple films which I had in my collection, in multiple copies from VHS upwards. But there's a lot of tie back to it. And again, like The Thing, it didn't perform well in the box office.
But there's a different reason why The Thing didn't perform well. There was 82, you had Blade Runner, you had, what is it,
exactly.
Conan. You had so many movies coming out in the same year that it was crazy.
Yeah.
That's the only reason why The Thing didn't do well at the time.
What we're seeing is that The Thing is almost universally praised because it's a freaking well-done movie. I mean, hats off to John Carpenter on that.
Arguably the greatest horror movie ever made.
Yeah.
Arguably.
And then we're floating back to The Blob, which came out at a reasonably similar time, dealt with another remake of a 1950s movie, and it didn't, I don't feel like it
same
got
decade,
the love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
so
it didn't
get the love that it needed, if you know what I mean.
And you know, like I'm with you, Steve, because like, you know, we get so much re-releases at the moment, and I have not seen a re-release of this movie since like the early 2000s.
Yeah.
It got re-released in 2019 and then again because of 4K in 2023. But it's not one of those movies that, you know, got treated as well as big studio movies. And because ultimately TriStar was a big studio back then. So
back then,
you know, So it definitely resonated with us as teenagers. You know, if you're in our age bracket, you definitely have watched this movie for the same reasons that, you know, it was marketed to us poorly. Because like we said, there was no budget that went into telling people to go watch this movie, but we found it in the home video. I didn't go to the movies to watch it. Steve,
no,
you got it in the video store, right?
Video store.
The cover alone must have attracted you to it.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, it brings us to the color of The Blob. You know, originally it wasn't meant to be pink. It was meant to be green.
Pink. Yeah.
Steve pointed out the titling sequence. The more we're looking at it, I was like, oh my God, this feels so X-Files. Because the movie was made in 87, came out in 88, but it feels like a 90s movie, man. It doesn't feel like a 1980s movie. So, Ricky, how did you feel about the aesthetics? Did it feel like an 80s movie or a 90s movie? What did you think?
I don't know. It's for me, it kind of had that like flourish of like this is we're marking the end of the 80s. We're trying something new. We're trying to have like a more modern look to everything without it being like, you know, swept hair and all of that stuff. And yet there were still like moments in it where, yeah, you're right. There is a little bit of that creeping like early 90s horror film about it. But really, a lot of the aesthetics, like the mullet, the haircuts, the you know, the cheerleader outfits, all the costuming and all of that stuff. There's something very like early 80s about it. But then like you have got stuff like the jib shots, which I don't know if the jib shots were like as common in the 80s as they were in the 90s. And then you've got there was my biggest problem with this film is that there is so much good about this film. There is so many good mechanics about this film. And for some reason, I feel like at the end, I kind of felt let down. And I still, I'm like constantly talking back and forth with Sally about this for the past like 48 hours of like, why am I not endeared to this version of the Blob as I kind of was to the 50s one, even though the 50s one was like all talk. But yes, the look of the film, I agree with you. There's something like almost like revolutionary about the way it looks, the way it's shot, you know, in comparison to like an early 80s horror film.
Yeah. I'm in two minds about what you just said, though, because I understand your point of view on it. 90s cinema, and this is going to be controversial, particularly when it comes down to sci-fi and horror, was not as groundbreaking as 80s cinema. Like by a lot, not by a little.
Yeah.
So when it comes down to aesthetics, I'm actually shitting on this a little bit by saying that it looked more 90s. If anything, actually, there's two things that it kind of evoked when the movie started. I started thinking first of an episode of The X-Files. If you look at the opening sequence of this movie, all the shots of the town, it just felt like that. And then if I have to go further back, it reminded me of The Twilight Zone. But the X-Files was my Twilight Zone and yours. You know what I mean? Like, it was an episodic kind of, oh, this is weird kind of thing. And that's what I kept thinking about, man. You go and rewatch the opening sequence. And that doesn't make it groundbreaking to me. It doesn't.
Yeah, but I've got to say, the slowest thing about this film is the intro.
Yeah, it's the intro. Definitely 100%.
The intro is so slow. But what you're trying to say is that it instantly reminded you of either a made-for-TV movie or it reminded you of a TV series that we know.
Not exactly. Yeah. Not exactly. What I'm trying to... First of all, one of the things that's established in the opening of this movie is that it's small-town America. You're giving shots of a church. You're giving shots of the diner. You're giving shots of the school. You're giving shots of the square, the public square. So there's a very civic vein running through this. The main characters that are authority in this are... The people that count in a small town, you have the priest, you have the sheriff, you have... So we are exposed to all the landmarks. Yeah. Even the pharmacy is in the opening sequence of this movie. So there's a reason why the shots are there. It's not... I can't explain it, but there's
it's
something...
also if, the situation that the director actually looked for a town with a single street to say small town.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. But they did that well. Maybe at the time, you're right, 88, is that even 80s anymore? That's the idea. Like 88 is virgin 90s, you know what I mean? Like if you look at Alien feels like an 80s movie, not like a 70s movie in my book. You know what I mean? Like it's, but that's me. There's something about decades that it's not so demarked by the number anymore. I'm going to have to cut the burp out.
I think
there was no way for me to contain it. Better out than in.
The reason why I was talking about like it reminds me of an early 80s movie is probably because if you ask me what do I remember better, The Blob or The Stuff from 85,
I
would remember scenes from The Stuff more, and The Stuff has that like really slow intro where they show you every single part of this quarry mine before the stuff spews out.
Larry Cohen, the foundation of trauma.
Yeah, and the stuff, it was he went on to make A Return to Salomon's Lot, but he originally made It's Alive. Yeah. That's what put him on the map.
Gotcha.
I have vague memories of the stuff. I can't remember a lot of it. I think it's something I'm going to have to rewatch.
I remember the VHS Gabba.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
The one with screaming.
The horror kind of.
Screaming face
where everything's oozing out.
Apparently, David Bruckner, which is the director of really good horror that came out recently, if you haven't seen it, check out The Ritual by him and The Night House, I think. David Bruckner took it upon himself to release a third remake of The Blob. People online, particularly in our weekly, in the other weekly communities, some people were really negative. There's a lot of people that when it comes down to remakes, because of the saturation of, you know, unnecessary remakes, I get some people are jaded, fine. But to shit on something before it's even, you know, this David Bruckner is a good director. People were complaining about the remake of a remake, just the idea. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I get
understand.
It.
Yeah, I mean,
but I look forward to it.
He also did the Hellraiser remake, which personally, I thought the Hellraiser remake was okay. It was fine.
I didn't like it. I had a screening here. I fucking hated it. So I hope I wish you didn't remind me, because I was excited about The Blob until you reminded me of this.
Bad.
Anyway, okay. Well, then imagine if it wasn't Bruckner, because, you know, if you enjoyed it and you're still a Hellraiser fan, that means they did good work. It's not rocket science. The Blob, as a concept, it's not a high concept. There's no layers here. We're not talking about Cronenberg. You know, it's a simple monster movie, and you just have to do it, pace it well. You know, the guy is very competent, and he's done creature features before, because if you've seen The Ritual, the reveal of that creature is amazing. If you haven't seen The Ritual, if you're listening to this, or you, Ricky, you got two movies to watch now.
No, so I've already seen The Ritual. I love The Ritual.
Okay, yeah. There you go. Yeah. I know you're going to make time, because most of the time you watch reruns of ER and while listening to Tool, that's fine.
No, get this right. I rewatch Dawson's Creek. Over and over again. Can we get that correct?
Holy
all right,
fucking
there we
shit,
go. Yeah.
Mate. Again, too much. Too much, dude. Anyway.
So what about wrapping this up? It's a pretty good idea.
Good
isn't
idea.
It?
Yeah. Let's bring it there. Let's bring it to a close by talking about Del Close. The Priest.
The Priest. Yeah, definitely. 100%.
So, I thought we already talked about Del Close.
No, the final sequence,
man.
The final sequence.
So he goes from priest to preacher, doesn't he?
Yeah. And very much in a scarred kind of situation with the blob's attack from him. And
who could have known that you could contain such a biological weapon inside a mason jar?
Mason jar. What's he feeling it?
It's fucking ridiculous ending. Did they fucking freeze the thing? Did he keep the jar in his fridge? Like, what the he's, fuck?
So, but he's, but obviously the last few sections are pulsing. So he's waiting to release this back on the earth.
I really wish we could go back to a fucking time in which movies were 90 minutes, dude.
Yeah.
We're talking about Romulus, and our 2 hours actually was damaging to the movie. You don't have to pad it. You don't, there's no need to layer these characters more than what you would do with a little exposition. 95 minutes. It aided the pacing of this movie. The movie, say what you like about it, but it paces furiously. And something that paces furiously makes for entertainment. Simple as that.
That's it.
So,
and
that 90,
I have to say that Frank Darabont's writing in this humanized the characters as well. So you felt invested when the characters died. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. He does that very well, man. Don't forget that this is the creator of The Walking Dead. It was all about small town America. There's a lot of those relationships that are developed in that show because you have the time to get to layer them, right? Because it's episodic. But you can see Darabont does civil servants very well. It's like he talks about institutions in broad strokes and with nuance as well, like the clergy, the cops. If you remember... Yep. He was the perfect choice for the first and second season or whatever, The Walking Dead, before they cut him out. But he's still credited as the creator because it is the story of a cop. You know, like most of the it seems to me that even The Mist at Small Town America, again, coming together. It's a very similar movie to The Blob, dude. And again, there's the dystopian vein running through it. There's parallels to be made between The Blob and The Mist. Those two, you know. Anyway, Steve, you picked this movie, so I'm not going to ask you. Ricky's gone silent. Ricky, how do you rate this movie? Can you recommend it? And you have the floor, sir. Score it.
I've got to admit, I went silent because I started reading into, like, I basically went down a rabbit hole of Hellraiser.
Oh, my anyway. God.
Fucking online. I was like, Hellraiser. That's awesome. Anyway. Look, I'm having a lot of trouble with this film in terms of...
It's not a film. This is a movie.
A movie.
Call it a movie.
This is but not like, look, an what art a... film.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're making a movie, film, movie. There's motion a distinction. Picture.
This is a fucking movie, dude. This is not a motion picture either. The Untouchables is a motion picture.
Okay. All right. Whatever. Yeah, this is a movie. Like the semantics.
Semantics. Okay.
Okay. Well, what I'm finding really difficult about this is that this has all the elements of a movie that I love. It has great special effects. It has great camera movement. It's really tight. It's really fast. All the information you're given is like amazing. But there's something about it that I still couldn't attach myself to the character.
It's nostalgia, dude. This movie doesn't have the nostalgic element attached for you. I get it. But, I get it.
Like, and I didn't even talk about like the kitchen scene that I thought was amazing. And
the kitchen scene's amazing.
One of the dads in it. Yeah, it's phenomenal.
The kitchen scene's amazing, followed by the telephone box scene, which again was amazing. Yep, yes. Like, the mannequins used in that and everything was amazing.
Perfect.
I even wrote a note down here was the song Stinkfist by Tool. And like inspired by the kitchen scene, you know, fingers past the borderline, knuckles past the borderline, you know. Like, anyway,
yeah.
So there's so much about it that I love in B movies.
I don't think Stinkfist is about this, dude. Stinkfist is about something else.
Don't tell people what it's about.
We're gonna get you fired, buddy.
I mean, me saying the word Stinkfist is probably fireable, right?
Rate this movie. Go on.
But I couldn't attach myself to the characters. And I also know that recently I keep going for 7 out of 10. I keep saying, oh, this movie, 7 out of 10. But I'm
finding it doesn't have to be a round up 7. Like,
yeah, so I'm going to go for a 7.5.
You rate this a 7.5?
Like, because I could, like, look, the way I see it is that if I was saying it was a 3 out of 5, then
how the
it'd
fuck
be
do you
6
go back
out
down to a 3. I don't understand how your algorithm works.
Like, so 3 out of 5 or
3 out of 5 would make it a 6 out of 10, right? But it's better than that. It's better than that. The effects are better. The camera works better. It's better than a 3 out of 5. It's better than a 6 out of 10. But it's
what is
not
the unit of measure for your rating?
Like, okay. This is why I'm finding it difficult. So I'm just going to say this, right? 7.5
disembodied limbs. That's really high, dude. That's a very high score for this one. I don't know what the
fuck
you are
anymore.
Yeah, but
you see, like, again, I can't.
Oh, my God.
I love the special effects.
Yeah, but
love
you're saying
hammer.
It like you've got Chuck Russell's gun to your head.
There's so much I love about it that if it was part of another film, no question, it would be amazing. I love all the work of David Cronenberg. I love all the work of David Lynch. I love all of this stuff that this movie has.
But you're contradicting yourself. I'm saying the 7.5 is very high.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying. I can't give it a 3 out of... I can't give it a 6 out of 10. I can't give it a 6 out of 10. That's too low. Because there's so much work that goes into this movie. There's so many good things about this movie. Maybe it's a 7, maybe it's a 6.5.
No, it's a 7.5. You gave it a 7.5 now.
I just can't give it a 6. I don't want to give it a 7, and I'm definitely not giving it an 8. It's not an 8 out of 10.
That's fine.
No.
That's your score.
No, it's not an 8 out of 10. So is it a 7.5? Is it a 6.5? I'm having a real difficulty. But whatever I've decided on is between 6.5 to 7.5.
No, you said 7.5. You said 7.5 disembodied limbs. Okay. Steve?
It's a 7. The reason why I say it's a 7, I think the cast is amazing. I think the special effects are
this
amazing.
This makes no sense. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You chose this movie. Fucking got me midweek to sit down and watch this movie. I watched this movie. Ricky watched this movie. And Ricky rated this movie higher than you.
Yeah.
How is this possible?
I'm talking about the simple fact that I've watched this movie a lot of times, especially as a kid. And I may have jumped on it, and it's not. It's
regrets.
Definitely.
You got regrets.
I got regrets because there are points in this movie that I was really excited to see again. And you know how I was jumping up and down on the fucking
when Can Man came on, you had a seizure.
Can Man.
Like you got posters of Can Man in your house. Like
okay. Yeah, definitely 100%. Phil Beck. Billy Beck, I think his name is. But the whole point with this movie is I went back into it without watching it in probably 20 years. And there are some points in this where I will say it's definitely not an 8. It's same as what Ricky's saying here. It's not The Untouchables. So I'm going to rate it in the sense of 7 out of 10 rings from a horrible person.
You're a piece of shit because that was going to be my unit of measure. You just stole that from me. I was going to use championship rings. Oh, fucking hell, I need to find something else. You're unbelievable, mate. Oh, I swear to you, that was my unit of measure. You stole it.
I didn't steal it. That was mine.
Okay, that's all right. I'll use something else. So how many championship rings?
Seven championship rings. Because I still truly like this movie. I think it's a great, fun popcorn movie. Okay. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. This is a 6 for me. It's a very generous 6, by the way. As in, it would have been in the 5. That's not a bad thing.
It's above average.
Yeah. And I've got a lot of stuff that is between 5 and 6 that I enjoy watching, but, you know, that's what it's rated because there's other stuff that takes priority over them. But this is a 6, and I'm doing this because I don't want to break your heart, Steve, because I know this movie means a lot to you. So out of respect, it's a 6. It was enjoyable to watch. It paces furiously, and it makes me long for a time in which movies were shorter. Because if I want to watch something that has enough time to actually layer something and give enough exposition and, you know, just time for characterization, I watch episodic drama. I don't watch a movie for that. You know, the story needs to develop and tie itself by a certain amount of time. This is driving through and through. It reeks of a different time in cinema. That's not a bad thing. That is not a bad thing at all. If this would be the ultimate driving movie for the 80s, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, this is a driving movie.
I'm giving it credit. Absolutely, I'm giving it credit. But it's a 6, and it's 6 mullet wigs. 6 Brian mullets. Greasy rebel mullets. And that's all this is.
That's great.
What are we doing next week, guys?
I don't know. Pinky, what have we got?
I don't know either.
Planned for next week. Brain?
I don't think I've got no plan.
I like that we keep acting this out because you know exactly that we're never going to tell people what we're doing next week. So.
I mean, like,
let's just keep doing it.
I'm going to go to work next week for sure. Yeah.
Oh man.
Don't. I'm still on a holiday, so that's it.
Oh, but by the way, Steve, where are you at the moment?
I'm in a chateau in the north of France with 30 other people.
You sound like you've been sent there in exile, dude.
No, I'm really enjoying myself. I had a great time last night. We got a pool. We've currently got people pretending to be mermaids in the pool, which is quite cool.
Before it was wholesome and something the family could share, an anecdote about your holidays, and now it's hedonistic. There's mermaids in the pool. There's another reason why we'd really, really want Ricky to get fired.
There's goats in the pool.
Yeah, there's mermaids in a pool in France.
So we
everyone's listening to Sing First.
And geese. Yeah.
Doom, doom. Listing First.
Yeah. I think I know what song I'm ending this episode with.
Beware of the blob.